This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm News Director Sarah Bohannon. Today we'll hear from State Assemblymember Mike Gibson on his bill that would make the carotid artery restraint by law enforcement illegal. We'll also hear from Shasta College's president about the community college's transition to online education in the spring due to the pandemic and its plans for the summer and fall. If you have questions or comments, leave them on our message line 433-9216 or go to our website, mynspr.org. For Wednesday, June 10th, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. First, the news.
For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert. Following several days with fewer fatalities, state health authorities reported both an uptick in deaths and a marked increase in new confirmed cases. The California Department of Public Health reported 79 deaths Wednesday, more than twice Monday's figure. The number of deaths in California blamed on COVID-19 is now 4,776. The department also recorded more than 2,700 new infections, close to twice Monday's total. The number of confirmed infections in the state is now 136,191. Governor Gavin Newsom, while meeting community leaders in Oakland Wednesday, told the Los Angeles Times that an uptick in cases was very much expected as a result of lifting restrictions on business and social activities. Meanwhile, infections in the North State appear to be spreading more rapidly, with new cases found in half a dozen counties since Tuesday. The total number of cases across the 11 counties now stands at 289. Over the past week, Butte County has seen a small spike in cases and now has the most in the region at 73. Sutter County reports 67. Shasta County has identified 47. Yuba County, 33. Glenn County, 21. Siskiyou County, 14. Tehama County, a dozen. Colusa County, 7. Lassen County, 6. Plumas County, 4. And Trinity County, 2. At least 15 North State patients are currently hospitalized. Fatalities across the region remain at 9. In other news, in Chico Tuesday, about 100 people urging a comprehensive overhaul of local police practices, training, and transparency gathered in City Plaza as a city council meeting was getting underway. Demonstrators called for a sustained effort, and speakers called on concerned citizens to seek elected office. Chico resident Anata Okonkwa was among the speakers. She said among the reasons officers overuse force lies with the recruitment of armed service veterans, people trained to use deadly force but not properly assessed and retrained for an entirely different mission. She also said a culture clash between officers and the communities they serve can lead to unfortunate incidents.
If you have a person who comes from a racially homogenous background, he's been around all mostly white people, what he knows about Black and Latino culture comes from the media, and then you assign him to a Black and Latino neighborhood to patrol, well, that doesn't work very well because he's already ingrained with these biases.
Okonkwa said those patrolling minority communities should be from those neighborhoods.
Because a lot of times there's a big demographic and racial disparity between the cop who is policing the Black neighborhoods and the people themselves. They don't speak our languages. They don't know us. They don't know our body languages. They don't know us. So therefore, we in their minds are already predatory.
The rally ended peacefully. For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert.
This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Efforts to change laws, funding, and certain policies in law enforcement and policing are being debated in states and communities across the country after the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis that happened now over 2 weeks ago. Today we'll turn to Beth Ruyak, the host of Insight at CAP Radio, for a discussion she had on Wednesday about reassessing police policies and restraint legislation with California Assemblymember Mike Gibson. Gibson has drafted legislation to make the practice of police use of the carotid artery restraint illegal in the state. Beth started the conversation around George Floyd's funeral, where he was laid to rest in Houston on Tuesday.
In yesterday's funeral, which was broadcast publicly, George's niece, Brooke Williams, said her uncle's death was not just murder, but a hate crime.
These laws need to be changed No more hate crimes, please. Someone said, make America great again. But when has America ever been great?
During the service, Houston's mayor announced a ban on chokeholds in what he said would be an even broader executive order on policing. Many local and state leaders are looking at their laws and the potential for reform. That includes Governor Gavin Newsom, who announced a change in practices for California last Friday.
I am immediately directing POST, which is our police officers' training, to end the training of that practice. And I could not be more pleased. No sooner did we make a commitment on this proposal that a member of the legislature, Mike Gibson, to his credit, just introduced a piece of legislation that I will support and sign as soon as it gets to my desk to legislatively end that practice in the state of California. We did that years and years ago as it relates to chokeholds, decades ago, understandably, but not some of these techniques on strangleholds. And we have got to update our practices.
So you heard the governor make reference to Assemblymember Mike Gibson and his legislation. The Assemblymember is a Democrat. He represents the 64th District, which is part of Los Angeles County. He was elected in 2014, and he's joining us by phone. Mr. Gibson, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Can I start with a little broader question? What has George Floyd's death and the time of uprising and protests since provoked internally for you?
Well, first of all, you know, my prayers goes out to the Floyd family. This is just tragic for not only his family, but also for his country. And I hope that we take a second look at what transpired and how we need real reform in California around our police officers and how they conduct arrests here in the state of California. And so we're moving with that in mind by having introduced 1196.
So you didn't really name an emotion or some of your own thoughts in that, but perhaps that will speak to how and when your decision to create this legislation evolved.
Well, it evolved. First of all, I was born in Watts. And I lived through the civil unrest that took place in 1992. And I read about what transpired in the Watts riot in the 60s. And so what has taken place in my mind is a crying, is a loud voice for change taking place in our country. And it needs to start right now. People cannot wait any longer. They're demanding change, and they're demanding change right now. And so what has evolved in my mind is action, is a call to action, and people standing up and letting their voices be heard. Because Dr. King said that silence is a form of betrayal, and I refuse to be found guilty of being silent.
Tell me about the specifics of your bill then, and the extent to which you looked at what was already in place in the state of California and what was the potential now for reform.
Absolutely. First of all, the bill came out of the death of George Floyd, plain and simple. I watched the video. I was in horror of what I saw, a murder unfolding right before our eyes. And listening to the voices. And so this is a step in the right direction, and I'm grateful to have the support of our governor, who's indicated last week that he would sign this bill to get this bill gets to his desk. And my goal is to making sure that this bill, in fact, gets to his desk. I believe that we've seen in our country's history where we've had these kinds of public protests and time again. When will we ever take heed to the history and write a new narrative for our future? And I believe the time is now, and I'm doing my part.
So the governor referenced that the state had already addressed chokeholds, and I'm sorry for some people who might not be comfortable with the specific details, but I do want to talk about the hold that you're addressing, or holds, and I'm trying to understand how encompassing it is. There is this particular carotid artery restraint. It's sometimes called the sleeper hold. I believe your bill addresses that. Is it also addressing chokeholds? Is it addressing other techniques, as the governor referenced?
Absolutely. It is addressing chokeholds that was used when I was in Los Angeles, when I grew up in Los Angeles in Watts. We had a police chief that was racist that said, you know, the reason why black people died while police officers doing or using chokeholds is because their necks were so thin. Right. So in my bill in 1196, it banned chokeholds and also the carotid restraint. The carotid restraint is when a person places their knee on your neck, which restricts and stops the blood from flowing through the brain that causes unconsciousness. And then it leads to death, as we have seen with Brother George Floyd.
So, Assemblymember Gibson, might there be exceptions at some point in the language? And what is the discussion around any exceptions? And I guess another way to phrase this is, how wide a ban might you be able to find support for?
Well, 1196 places a total ban in the state of California. When you have large police departments such as Los Angeles, San Francisco, who banned this practice years and years ago, they're still able to make arrests. And you look at what just transpired, you know, a few weeks ago with the city of San Diego and the county of San Diego, and you're starting to see systematically departments banning it. But those are policies they're banning, right? We need a ban statewide to create a uniformity in this particular area, prohibiting law enforcement officers not using these methods and or techniques when effecting arrests. And so we, again, hope that California has always led the way. We hope that California leads the way and other states follow by putting into policy, into state statute, a ban of these kinds of methods and techniques.
If there is law enforcement lobbying for some sort of exception, for example, in a lethal force situation, I don't know all the scenarios that it might be considered. Where are you in terms of the possibility of either an amendment or an exception, that kind of language?
Well, right now, I'm not accepting anything. I am moving forward, but I welcome law enforcement to sit down and be part of the conversation to see if, in fact, there is a compromise to some degree. But the spirit of this policy is to ban these practices and these techniques in the state of California.
Has a Senate hearing been scheduled yet for the bill?
I believe that's going to take place next week, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay. And could we talk a bit about your take on this time of protests and the interface with COVID-19 and the particular heightened numbers in the African-American community? And I think I'd like to gauge your view on all of that together.
Sure. I think it's incredible. We are witnessing history in the making. You have seen this time where literally people are placing themselves at risk by going outside, but it's powerful because they're motivated for change in our country, and they're doing that in peaceful protests and demonstrations and raising their voices. What I pray is that, you know, that one, racism, we will actually take a real hard look at the racism, the biases that plague our communities, our states, and our country. And I hope that we will look at, one, investing in low-income communities, opportunities, job training, and also ending poverty. All these things are things that we can do collectively as a state and as a country to address a lot of the systemic issues that we're faced with right now today. And so when you look at COVID-19, people are saying that I'm willing to risk it all to allow my voices to be heard on the injustice that's taking place when it comes down to police brutality. And please, don't get me wrong. There are bad people in every profession in our walks of life. And we cannot paint one person or one agency with a broad brush. There are bad apples in law enforcement, and I am saying they have to go. Let me just repeat that one more time. They have to go and allow the real, genuine, authentic police officers to do police duty. And those are the ones who are really signed up to do the work, serve and protect our community. But we have individuals who seek to utilize and abuse the badge and also the authority they have. And they hurt people. And in this case, with George Floyd, they kill people.
That was California Assemblymember Mike Gibson speaking with host of Insight at CAP Radio, Beth Ruyak. You're listening to special coverage from North State Public Radio. More just ahead. This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. During this pandemic, we've been checking in with schools who first had to pivot to online education and are now having to make decisions on how they're going to approach the fall. To learn more about the experience and plans of one of the North State's community colleges, NSPR's Ken Duvall spoke recently with Dr. Joe Weiss, president of Shasta College in Reading. One of the first things Ken asked was how the faculty, who teaches about 9,000 students each semester, transitioned into a fully online curricula at the beginning of this pandemic.
Well, at Shasta College, we were about a third online at the start of the spring semester. We're tending to see wait lists for students and more demand over time in that area. I think they're trying to balance their commutes and their work schedules when you're in half online courses. It's a little easier to plan your work and other duties, I think. So a lot of our faculty were very experienced, and it was not a transition at all. But many of our faculty had not done online work. So there was a lot of adjustment, a lot of learning our faculty had to do, a lot of support we tried to provide through our classified staff and other opportunities. It was somewhat unique. We decided to move our spring break forward about 2 or 3 weeks right after we decided to go online to give our faculty a little longer time period to adjust if needed. So that was difficult and had its challenges, and our faculty were really heroic in doing all the work and all the learning to adjust overnight to this situation.
Yeah, the rapidity of the onset of this has got to have been really disorienting. What kind of reports are you getting back from students about their experience with online teaching?
Yeah, there were lots of reports back from students and a lot of help we tried to provide. One of the big challenges we heard and tried to provide solutions for was, you know, lack of connectivity in some of their homes to the internet, or high-speed internet at least. It's difficulty having the right devices to be online. I mean, many of our students were choosing not to take online courses because obviously they preferred not to do it that way. So the students had many, many challenges to overcome. Our foundation stepped up. We did some fundraising and had some other funds that could be reallocated and helped with purchasing and giving out many devices to help students connect, or Chromebooks, or those sorts of things, and as well as emergency grants up to $250 for students. So our foundation helped. The CARES Act money came in. It was difficult to get that distributed, but we did distribute out about $1.7 million to students through the federal CARES Act money. So that was a big help as well. But still, there are areas in our northern communities where there's no cell service. So a hotspot doesn't work. There's no good internet connections, or it's very expensive to be able to do that. So that's still a challenge we're working to overcome. We have ordered and will have installed this fall, as we're remaining, I'll say, primarily online. We are arranging, as safety allows, for some of our science labs and some of those difficult courses to be able to do labs on campus with appropriate safety measures and social distancing for fall. But we've also ordered some equipment to put in our parking lots so that we can allow students to come and connect to the internet, you know, in their cars, if there's no other way for them to do that. And so that's another solution we're having for the future.
Interesting. So you've created a hotspot there. I understand that the state at least had intended to provide roving hotspots for rural areas and to increase connectivity. Have you seen any of that?
You know, I've been trying to follow that as well. I haven't seen any of it yet here at the college, or our ability to participate in that. Besides, you know, we purchased and we're loaning out hotspots to students. And again, sometimes that worked and sometimes it did not, because of just the locations of various homes and whether or not certain cell towers reached certain areas. But yeah, I'm very interested in the state's effort to help close that digital divide, and the emphasis they're putting on that is a positive result of this pandemic, although I think it's taking time to come up with the solutions.
So here we are. Spring term is essentially at its end, but coming right down the pike is our summer sessions, and then there's the fall semester. How are you planning for that, especially given so many unknowns?
Yeah, so for this summer, we had decided early on to move as much as possible, majority online. Our enrollment for summer looks very close to last summer, and we might be down a percent or two, but you know, that looks pretty close for us. For fall enrollment, it's a little too early to tell, to make comparisons at this time. But we did open enrollment methods for fall, so that's starting. We're trying to make fall majority online as well, in anticipation of a possible resurgence. So the decision was made because we felt the disruption that happened by a middle of the semester transition this spring had to happen, but was very challenging. So by making a decision earlier to do more online in the fall, it kind of removed that disruption potential and provide more certainty for our students and our faculty for fall. So I anticipate higher demand in fall, but it's hard to know. And nothing's typical right now. In a typical recessionary period, demand skyrockets for community college opportunities for retraining and for education. But this is such a different scenario that we don't really know. Will there be a surge in demand? Will being mostly online be a discouragement for some of that demand? Will, you know, all these questions are being discussed around the state, and it'll take time for us to figure out where it really ends up.
Could you just very briefly explain how the role of community colleges has changed in the last decade or so? They've become much more central to the fulfillment of higher education.
Yeah, what's really satisfying at working for a community college, especially here in the far north, is we are the community's college for the most part, and we're the gateway to the opportunity for educational pursuit. And so, you know, anywhere from career programs that are focused on, you know, nursing and fire technology and the other industrial areas, we're the place people pursue that for the middle class. And we're a very important part of our communities. And then, you know, for transfer, you know, it's a very affordable way to get that first 2 years of a four-year degree completed. So, you know, it's fun to be at a community college in far Northern California, where we are such an essential part of the community. You know, the move to online has been a very interesting twist, although Shasta College, like I said earlier, has been slowly growing over the years to being about a third of its course offerings online. There's still a lot of students who want to mix that online and face-to-face reality in classrooms. So, and then a lot of programs where it's just kind of almost a requirement, right, to make it a successful learning environment. And then to try to be responsive to the community needs. As community needs change, especially in our career tech areas, we try to offer certificates and programs that meet the needs of our businesses and industries, and try to be more nimble in those areas to be able to make changes. And our partners are great in the business community, providing input to the curriculum and the needs they have for their employees. And so that would be a summary of how essential our community colleges are in our regions.
Let's turn to budget. The California legislature released its budget, and it's much more favorable, apparently, to education, including support for community colleges, than the governor's budget. How are you sleeping?
Oh, you know, I'm sleeping fine. We're better positioned as a college than we were before the Great Recession. We have a good reserve account and have some other funds we've built up for our healthcare liabilities that we didn't have, 12 years ago. And so we're positioned to be able to adjust without overreaction is kind of the way I explain it. Don't have to make quick decisions that aren't well thought through. But that being said, the state's budgetary approach this year is just full of uncertainties that are new and different. And so you're right. The governor's approach is, well, here's the cuts you're going to take unless the federal government comes through and provides some relief. And the legislature's approach is, we're assuming the federal government's going to come through and provide billions and billions of dollars. And so here's what you can plan on. But then if it doesn't happen, then we're going to, mainly for education, do these massive deferrals where you expend the money this year and in a future year, we'll pay you back for it. And so basically borrow from all the education district's reserve accounts like ours that I was mentioning earlier, that's helping me sleep at night. So very, very different approaches. And, if I had a crystal ball, I'd say, I hope they end up somewhere in the middle where it's not all borrowing from the future and I call it a little more realistic approach. But, the governor's proposal of an 8% general fund cut, but the expectation of still educate the same number of students and keep doing what you've been doing is a big pill to swallow as well.
That was Dr. Joe Weiss, president of Shasta College in Reading, speaking with NSPR's Ken Duvall. And that is your program. As always, if you have thoughts or comments for us, leave them on our message line 433-9216 or go to our website, mynspr.org. Today's special coverage was produced by Mark Albert, Ken Duvall, Christian Solis, Andre Bayek, Angel Hiracha, Eric Radaville, Kylo Castilla, and Phil Wilkie. Our technical producer is Matt Fidler. Thank you for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, news director at North State Public Radio, and this is Special Coverage. Tune in each weekday evening at 6:30 or catch the rebroadcast the following morning at 8:30. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and stay tuned to NSPR.